afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Crawford School and to the Australian National University. My name is Stephen Howells, and I'm the Director of the Development Policy Centre, and we're hosting today's event, so welcome from us, as well as from AusAid, who have played a key part in putting this event together and making it possible, and the Australian Disability and Development Consortium. Let me begin by acknowledging the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and by paying our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. It's a really I think interesting topic and good format that we've got today, so I'm looking forward to a really stimulating 1.5 hours. We've called this the Disability Inclusive Development Forum. So I wanted to call it Disability Inclusive Development Q&A, but I think Tony Jones has copyrighted that. So we're calling it a forum. But the idea is it's meant to be very interactive and participatory. So we won't it won't be a traditional sort of academic format. I'll be asking some questions, and we'll be inviting questions from the floor. And I'll also be encouraging our panelists to, make comments, react to what their other panelists are saying, ask their own questions. So it should be quite freewheeling, fast-moving, and I'm sure we'll all learn something a lot. I think the other reason it's really, should be illuminating is because this is still a new topic. I know some of you here, including on this panel, are real experts in this area, but probably most of the people in the room aren't. Certainly for myself, I'd put myself in that category, and I could see people around the room who've got an interest in development, but perhaps haven't spent a lot of time thinking about the issues around disability in that context. Anyway, that's enough from me. Let me just introduce the three panellists, and then we'll start. I've asked them all to make sort of opening remarks, and then we'll follow that up and see how we go. So just starting at this end, let me introduce first Senator Montian Buntan, who's a senator from Thailand, and he has actually has an academic background, so welcome back to the university, as well as extensive studies in Thailand and then in the USA. He'd also was a university lecturer for 8 years. But he then left his teaching career behind, became full-time social activist in 2002. He's currently in his second four-year term as president of Thailand's Association of the Blind. He's been a senator since 2008, and he's also active internationally, including on the UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. His favourite slogan is, "I've given up on giving up." Then next to him and next to me is Setareki Makanawai, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Pacific Disability Forum. And he also is very active both in Fiji, where he's based, and internationally. He's currently the Chief Executive Officer of the Pacific Disability Forum, which is an umbrella organisation for over 20 Pacific-based disabled people's organisations. And he's, I should say, our centre takes particular interest in Pacific and PNG issues, so we're delighted to have you here. Seth has also been very involved in the development of AusAid's disability strategy. And I should add, all three members of the panel are part of the AusAid reference group, as I think it's called, for the Disability Inclusive Development Strategy, and they're meeting here today in Canberra. So once again, our thanks to AusAid for suggesting this event and making it possible. But going back to Seta, he's in recognition of his work, he's been presented with a number of awards, including the Pacific Regional Rights Resource Team 2008 Pacific Human Rights Special Citations Award. So it's an honour to have you here with us. And then finally, on my right, I have Charlotte McLean Nlapo, and she's the coordinator for the Office for Disability and Inclusive Development in the USAID. So it'll be very interesting to get a perspective from another very important donor on this whole issue. Prior to her appointment in USAID, she was with the World Bank where she worked in the East Asia and Pacific region. So haven't quite worked out whether we've overlapped, but it's nice to have a former colleague alongside me. I also served my time in the World Bank. She's a human rights lawyer with a particular interest in marginalised groups, and she has extensive involvement in South Africa. In 1999, she was appointed by President Mandela to the South Africa Human Rights Commission, and she was then reappointed by President Mbeki in 2002. She's also active internationally, in particular with the United Nations. So we have an extraordinarily distinguished, diverse group here, and a very international group. It's our great fortune to have you all. Thank you for giving up your time to be with us today. And let's get underway. So I'm going to just go along the table, and I'll start with you, Senator. You know, if you can just get the ball rolling by starting about, I guess, your own involvement, how you came to be involved in advocacy on the for the rights of people with disabilities, and you know, what sort of success you've had. What's been your experience in government in influencing policy?
Thank you very much, Steve, and very good afternoon to all of you here. It's an honor to share my experience and thoughts. Well, everything started with, you know, I grew up in a farm and, you know, being blind since birth and had to go through all kinds of difficulties, and especially when it comes to discrimination and inequality. But I didn't really, you know, get stuck with what I really encounter. I observe the ongoing struggle and movement of people of different categories. You know, starting from the democracy movement in Thailand in 1970s, when I was very young, I got very into political. I have a lot of interest in politics, including domestic and international politics, by the way. So when I grew up and I went to study in the United States, I got involved in several movements as well, this movement, and human rights issues. So with all of that and feeling that my opportunity, either through my own personal struggle or through luck or whatever you want to say, I don't want to be an exceptional person. I see that there's got to be something wrong, you know, that a few people can have some opportunity to succeed, to or fail, or some people could just fail all their lives. So, and upon my return from the United States, I got heavily involved in the blindness and disability movement in Thailand, starting from being an advisor first while teaching in university, and then I became full-time activist working from. You know, from then, I got involved in the youth movement of the World Blind Union. I became first vice president of the National Association of the Blind, Thailand Association of the Blind. And through that, I see the need to work with other sectors within the civil society, not only in the disability movement, but in other issues as well, because we cannot stand alone, work from our problems, but we need to be recognized. So when the position is, well, when the Constitution opened up for me to be nominated and elected as member of the Senate, I didn't choose to do so, but I was given mandate by unanimous, I would say, votes or agreement from disability communities in Thailand to be in the Senate House. And that also coincidentally worked at the same time as my role in the drafting and negotiation of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, where I got to meet Charlotte and a lot of people. So in that sense, I think we need to really look into how we can situate ourselves in our own personal struggle and share such common feeling with our people who are sharing the same situation with us, make ourselves assertive enough, and also make alliance with other groups of people. And I believe in political process. You know, when I say about political process, I mean politics within this disability movement, politics among civil society, and politics in the mainstream political establishment. What I have been able to do is mainly through legislation, formulation of national legislation, and also my influence and my active role in the international human rights law, such as CRPD, and also regional policy framework on disability issues. So being in the Senate doesn't mean that you can do everything, but you need to, again, get people's, at least they have to recognize our role, and they also have to recognize our contribution beyond our own issue. So that's what I've been doing for the past five years. I've been working in the area of people without legal status, you know, displaced people, and I've been dealing with the mainstream human rights issues. Also recently got involved more into the disastrous reduction. All of these things could accumulate my role and recognition of being a person with disability, but with this position, to advocate for ourselves, to advocate for our friends and colleagues, but also to contribute to the whole society. That's what we mean by being actively involved in the political process.
Okay, terrific. I think that's a very rich set of remarks, which we could discuss for a long time. We'll come back to a lot of those points. I think I'll turn now to you, Setta, and just ask you a sort of similar set of questions to reflect on your own experience in a very different context. You know, I can't imagine really two more different regions than the Pacific and Asia, and what progress you've seen during your time in terms of the rights of the disabled. I'll just, we have to share the microphones.
Okay. Sorry. I'll shift this across.
Yeah, it's just on your, yeah, oh, that's yeah. It, yeah.
Okay. Yes, thank you to ANU, thank you, Stephen, for the opportunity, to AusAid and also to ADDC, and to you, the audience that are here. It wouldn't be a forum without you sitting here, otherwise three of us would be talking to other two walls in this room. Unlike Santa Montiel, who's a good friend of mine over many years, I was not born blind. I was a sighted person until I was doing my last year at high school in an all-boys school in Suva, Fiji, in a boarding school. What struck me when I lost my sight, it kind of changed my life too. In many ways, the aspirations I had, the opportunities that were there as a sighted person, kind of diminished or almost gone when I became blind. So with aspirations to continue with life, and the people that I met across in those early years. And I think what is very important is the support system that's around you when something tragic like that happens, if I can call it that. To be able to put the pieces together and carry on with life. And then in trying to focus and trying to get on with life as a blind person, and the challenges that I faced really made me very angry. I was angry about trying to get used to being a blind person. I was angry with systems that are not there to support a blind person realize his dream, his aspiration. So with that, I guess, anger and a desire to make a difference. Santa Monica's slogan is, he's given up on giving up. Mine is on seizing every opportunity to make a difference. So I took it upon myself, and even trying to go to teacher's college. I wasn't wanting to, didn't want to be a teacher in the first place when I was growing up. But that opportunity came to go to teacher's college. As a blind person, I could not get a government scholarship. They don't do that time to blind people. You're not supposed to be at teacher's college. So we had to almost try to go through the back door or the window to get a scholarship. So I was aware of all these conversations, these arrangements. And I growing up in Fiji, in Suva, where there's a lot of barriers and challenges facing persons with disabilities, and I guess like Senator, teaming up with other people with disabilities in a disability movement in Fiji, and trying to address our issues and to raise awareness. So I guess the challenge that I took upon myself is I need to do something so that others who are coming after me do not go through the same hell, excuse the language. That is what I took upon myself as a personal goal, which I still kind of carry with me today. And doing that way, in Fiji, I managed to go through. I turned up for the first time at teacher's college. The teachers didn't know what to do with me. I guess probably not new to some in this room. But I had similar experience when I went to study at the University of Chattanooga in Tennessee. I also had a similar experience at the university I attended here in Australia, and I came to do my master's. It's almost like having to fight a battle all the time. You want to do something about yourself to make things better. And that's the fighting spirit that you develop in trying to change things. So then working at the School for the Blind, we managed to change things around. I managed to get a posting. Because I'm a blind person, I was literally supposed to be teacher of a blind school, though there was no special education course I did. And all my teaching practice was in regular schools, teaching sighted children. But then, I guess the thinking around, I guess having to live with the myth, having to live with perceptions about disability, enroll in public service as a civil servant, as a teacher, and being young at those time, and wanting to have an employment. Because I actually got married soon after I graduated from college, and my wife is sitting here. And even that experience, I mean, the negativity that surrounded my life in growing up, even a blind person was supposed to be married. Those things are kind of taboo, kind of are not normal. And then carrying that with me, with my other colleagues with disabilities, and trying to influence government to make things better, to become more positive, receptive, inclusive, the way they do business. So now things are changing in Fiji, and then taking on the responsibility beyond Fiji in the Pacific, and the work that I do now, which started many years ago. And also the same thing that was in the Pacific. At that time, there was only a couple of countries that were really, that had this, a movement of personal disabilities. So then I used to go to Thailand and Bangkok because of UN meetings and other parts of the Asia Pacific. It used to be one or two of us only. There was very little representation of the Pacific in those Asia Pacific forums. There was very little voice. And I was I used to admire my friend on my left here. There were other people that were championing their cause. So why should the Pacific be left behind? Why should geography, why should isolation, why should smallness of size, why should developing economy be the reason of why development should not be equal or be the same or similar. So then we also do also the opportunity with a few other colleagues, and then we said, let's work on forming an organization in the Pacific that usually call it this way, that look Pacific, that taste Pacific, that smell Pacific. That's the Pacific Disability Forum. And we took it upon ourselves and working with allies, and agreed totally with the senator here, we cannot do it alone. So we work with our partners, and said at that time, the colleague of my district of NZ8, I believe, is in this audience, and work with those that are possibly in government. So he's also a student here at ANU, I just met him here. So it's working with people who are, I guess, share your passion and vision to make things better. And looking back in the last few years, 10 years, that we've come a long way in the Pacific, from like 3-4 countries to now across the 16 Pacific countries and territories, even now 19, where you have disabled persons organization sharing the same passion and driven under the same agenda, and working with development partners like AusAid, though NZAid is decide to look elsewhere or do other things about development. Because I just told Stephen sometimes, and I asked him, and he corrected me, and rightly so, the argument in disability about economic development versus social development, and where do we fit in the middle. And sometimes, and what we've been talking about this week, the reference group, the costing, the cost-benefit analysis on work-related disability. Sometimes we are costed, just like as if we are a bridge or we are a building. So I think, these are the things, I guess, that kind of shaped my thinking and kind of drive me to do the things that I do, and probably have led to be why I'm here on this table. Thank you, Steve.
Excellent. All right, well, again, that's extremely, there's a lot to be said about that. I think we'll go on, though, and come back to you, Seda. Thanks a lot for sharing all that with us. So now, Charlotte, over to you. And I guess similarly open-ended in terms of your experience, but I guess you are from a donor, and we'd be particularly interested in hearing about your current work within the USAID.
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, I think I'd like to preface my remarks about my current work at USAID by saying that, you know, disability has been basically absent from the development agenda broadly. And this is not something that's unique to any one agency. It's just been the case broadly. And what's happened overall has been that disability has really been seen as a charity issue. And that people with disabilities have been seen as recipients and not necessarily as catalysts or facilitators of change and development. That is beginning to change, fortunately. And I think we're beginning to see more and more donors that are developing policies and that are thinking through how to program for disability-inclusive development. USAID has had a policy for a fair amount of time. The policy came out in 1997. So if you think about that, that's a long time ago. And that happened not because the administrator at the time thought, oh, gee, this is a good issue, we want to think about it, but because there was a strong disability movement in the United States that pushed the agency and said, you know, any U.S. dollars that are being used for development, for foreign assistance, should be thinking about disability and development. And that policy is essentially a non-discrimination policy. But of course, times have changed. The policy came out in 1997. We're in 2013, and much has happened in the development world. And we now have the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities that has been ratified by over 130 countries, unfortunately not by the US yet. Yeah. But I think that, you know, it has influenced the way we are thinking about disability inclusive development. So, I mean, I think there are a couple of issues that I've sought to focus on within the agency. But just maybe to back up a bit and say that my position at the agency is a new position. It's the first time ever that the agency has a full-time coordinator on disability inclusive development at a senior level. And my position was part of the Obama administration, so I was appointed by the president. And I say this not because I want to brag, even though I do want to brag, but because it's so important to have that political sense that this is really an issue for us to think about. I mean, there were so many other issues that could have been selected. So I think that that's really important. So having the political will at the highest level is absolutely essential. I think that that's been very important for me because I've been able to come into the institution, into the agency with that sense of gravitas and support of an administration. So what do I do when I get there? I mean, it's one of those situations where you're there now and the expectations are huge. They're huge from within the agency, but they're also huge from outside. So there's that external push and there's the internal push. So what I thought I would do was to focus on trying to institutionalize the issue within the agency, because we have a coordinator now. We don't know that we'll have a coordinator forever. So in trying to institutionalize it, I thought looking at embedding disability inclusive development into the policies of the agency would be important. And not necessarily the disability policy, but all the new policies that are coming out of the agency. So if you look at the suite of, say, there's a whole range of new policies that have come out of USAID, and they range from youth, gender, climate change, education. All of these include disability inclusive development. At some, you know, and they range, some more and some less. But the idea is that you want to make it part of everybody's work. It can't just be the work of the coordinator. It has to be something that's internalized by the agency, or as I like to say, it has to become part of the DNA of the agency. So I think that that's been very important. I think the other part to that is then finding ways to ensure that policies are translated into the programmatic piece of the agency's work. And that's difficult. That, I think, requires A, skilling up staff within the agency. So one of the things that we did was to develop an online course on disability inclusive development. It's a very basic course, but it really takes a staffer through what are the key issues and how do you do this. We're hoping then to do a second course that will drill down, you know, and be a bit more substantive in terms of some of the conceptual issues. So I think skilling up and building capacity in-house is absolutely key. I don't expect every single person in the agency to be an expert on disability inclusive development, but I do expect every single person in the agency to think about it when they're developing programs, whatever it is that they're developing. So that's been an important piece. I think linked to that is the need to have the necessary tools and matrix. So, you know, do you have the how-to notes? Do you have tools to assist staffers in thinking this through? And translating the policies into actual programs. And then I think, you know, the other piece is really just building the capacity in the countries in which we work. And that has been, in the case of USAID, I would say a strong point. So working to build the capacity of disabled people's organizations in the countries in which we work, I think has been really important. And I think what that does is it helps create the demand and the push. So we're having DPOs say to aid missions that may not be including disability, why aren't you doing this? And holding them accountable. So I think that that's a really important issue. I do think that there are some kind of common issues that have prevented a better kind of movement around, movement or advancement of disability within the global agenda. And I think that One is that it's there's some structural constraints. I think there are definitely some attitudinal constraints. So the whole issue around prejudice, fear, discrimination, and stigma remain a huge issue, and an issue that I think that we haven't paid attention enough to. And then structural, I mean, obviously you've got the physical, but I think it's more than just, as Rosemary loves to say, let's just get over the ramps. You know, it's not just the ramps. But it's about ensuring that you have strong institutions that can hold governments accountable, institutions that can ensure enforcement of legislation, codes, and standards that are in place. I mean, I've been to countries where you have just the most brilliant pieces of legislation. And then when you look around, you're like, oh, wow, you know, what happened here? But you don't have the institutions to actually ensure that there's compliance. I mean, I think there's just some common things that we need to think about as development practitioners, development scholars going forward, and that is that, you know, development cannot continue in the way that it does if it does not recognize and include 15% of the world's population, of which are people with disabilities. And that I think, you know, getting people with disabilities involved as participants, as contributors from the beginning, help getting them involved in the design of programs is really what we should be doing. I think what encourages me every day is that they are increasingly, as I said, a number of donors that are thinking about that are addressing the issue of disability inclusive development. But I think we're seeing a far greater sophistication amongst disabled people's organization in relation to this issue. I put out a call to academics, and actually maybe a challenge to academics. I know there are a couple in this room that are doing some great work, but I mean, broader than that, I think that we need to really start seeing academics thinking about the issue of disability and development, and, you know, really seeing it as a discipline and not as just, oh, gee, that's, you know, a trend or you know, an interesting issue. But it really is a discipline. And how do we bring these two disciplines together, the discipline of disability and the discipline of development? So I think really for me, some of the important aspects for addressing or trying to heighten the inclusion of persons with disability in the development world is providing voice for persons with disability, voice and agency, addressing issues around invisibility of persons with disabilities in our programming, and ensuring that we better understand what this means. And then I think finally working in the communities in which we work to do away with some of the very negative societal norms that don't recognize the value and worth of persons with disabilities. And I think I'll stop there.
All right. Thank you very much, Charlotte. I think it just shows the best talks are those without PowerPoints. I'm serious. I want to start the discussion, so please think of your questions. But I will just go back to our panel and see if any of you want to pick up on any of the remarks made so far. I mean, one common theme I picked up was the importance of politics and alliances for change. And I'd be interested in, you know, the sense of whether you see in your countries, Senator and Setter, whether you see that the political will there. And then also in terms of, you know, being an absent issue from development and what Charlotte said about the role of the donors, how useful you think our donors, you know, have been or could be on this issue, or whether it's an issue where change has to come from within. So any, would you like to, Senator,
sure,
start off the second round?
Yeah.
Just briefly.
Thank you very much. Well, we have planted the seeds of our involvement, as I mentioned earlier, that first starting with self-advocacy and then forming alliance with people with common issues, common problems and difficulties to face and to achieve. And then finally insert ourselves as important contributors to society. So that has paid the price, actually. We have gone in transition now from being solely put in the position of being recipient of charity help, moving forward towards being a rights holder and also effective and full participants in the mainstream social, political, economic sphere of the country. We're struggling now to... Seta just mentioned a while ago that people have been arguing whether disability inclusive development is a matter of putting extra costs. We're trying to redefine such a thing and try to explain to our government, not only Thai government, but government within this region, that it is actually a long-term social economic investment. And that's what I've been trying to do in my country as well. Because you believe it or not, right now you heard from Charlotte that we have 15% of the world population who have disabilities. And the number is going to keep growing. Not growing just because people recognize or proclaim themselves of being persons with disabilities, but because we are moving rapidly into aging society. We're moving into heavy industry. We're moving into more accidents and more environmental hazards and all kinds of things like that. So disability will be increased tremendously. Investing today is about long-term insurance for our future. So this is a really serious issue. We're not talking about somebody else, we're talking about everyone here in this room. So this is a very big task for myself and for my friends in my country. We are trying to involve all sectors to rethink disability, not as a minority group, but as something that could be with anyone and benefiting all people. So this is the big task that I've been coming across, and it's I'm still climbing the ladder, by the way. So this is my second run.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. So did you want to add to that?
The political will, it is very important. Charlotte did talk about that, and the politician on my left here, Senator Muntian, promotes that. It is very, very important. I'm hesitating because I don't want to talk about politics in Fiji. But
why not?
Nonetheless, there has been political will in Fiji. They've signed through the current regime. They've signed up to the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities in 2010. They've adopted a disability policy and have done other measures. But I think what is key is how those policies are implemented, the connection between policy and practice. Because we can have good policies, we can have good legislation, if it's not seeing the light of day, if it's not impacting the lives of people that matters the most as they remain in shelves in government departments or even in organizations, drawers, they're no good. No good to anybody, to those who develop it and to the beneficiaries of those policies. So I think that's it is important to have political will. It certainly helps drive the process of education for persons with disabilities. When it's political, it makes the space, it creates a space for us to be included, to be at the table. Because I think, and then that's the other thing I was going to mention about working with development partners or with governments. What I found in the work, you know, the experience I've had in, and whether it be a government officer in a rural Fiji, an outlying country, outlying island, and in the Pacific where traditionally and culturally disability is often related to ancestral curse, parental misdeed, that your parents did something wrong or stole money from the church offering, something like that. And then linked to the association even the witchcraft. So those kind of things really put us in a tight corner that when we try to claim for our space, and in a culture where you respect the elders, you kind of do what you're told. So you find yourselves in this space where there's a lot of oppression against you. And as a person with disability, with an addition of a disability around this cultural context, it can become very, very difficult. And you almost have to develop a hard, thick skin, I guess, which is what I did, I think, I suppose, to be able to help overcome these barriers. But I think once, and that's and when I share with other festival countries, sometimes getting us included to be at the table. What is the relationship? What is your attitude? If I come as a person with disability to you, in your office, you are a government officer, are providing services. What is the relationship, right? My argument is the relationship is never equal, even at that point. And it's a lot to do with our attitude. It's a lot to do with our judgment. Just a couple of weeks ago, and talking about Alliance, the Pacific Disability Forum is part of the Pacific Regional NGO Alliance, and we met with the Pacific Plan Review Team. And we were talking about, somebody talked about donor agencies coming with their big pockets. And I said, I don't think it's about big pockets. Development is not about having big pockets. It's about treating each other equally as equal partners in development. I think in the area of disability, I think that's what I found to have worked very well with your government in Australia through AusAid. We have been treated as an equal partner. We may not have, at the outset, what we actually need, but there are things that we bring to the table that we even need to consider, that is worth the respect, that's worth arguing the opportunity to be an equal partner in that space. Because, I mean, development is not just about money. Development is about practice, development is about how you become a partner to that, those providing the money to see those impact delivered and making impact on the ground. So I guess I've covered quite a few things in my second round here. So it's about overcoming this. In the Pacific, culturally, there's a lot of things going that make life tough for persons with disabilities. But how then we create the enabling environment? How we create a safe space for them to become themselves, for them to empower themselves and be empowered and supported so that they become equal partners in development. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Sedra. Good to hear those positive words about the AusAid approach. Charlotte, do you want to add anything at this stage?
Yes, I would like to, actually. I think that, certainly from a donor perspective, I think that there are a couple of things that, as Sedra said, you don't necessarily have to have deep pockets or bags and bags of money. I think, there are things like influencing the policy dialogue. You're at the table, you're talking about it, you're talking about disability inclusive development as part of an integral part of the larger development agenda, I think is really important. This may have obviously resource implications, but building capacity. Here I point to AusAid's awards. And I think that's a really positive example of how you can build capacity to address the issue of disability inclusive development going forward in partner countries. And I think just overall, donors could do a better job in terms of collecting disaggregated data on disability in the programs that we already have. And that's about going back to the drawing board and looking at what is it that we're doing, what type of data are we collecting, and then finding ways to include better data on disability. And then I think another area which is pretty obvious is the one around sharing best practices, and I think, you know, speaking, you know, donors talking to each other, donors talking to, you know, country partners is really important in that regard. Working with DPOs in that regard is also important. But I think there's also something else that we don't do enough of, and that's sharing what is possible. You know, I've worked in countries where people with disabilities can't imagine that you could have an accessible transportation system. It's just not something that they have started to think about because this is not, they've never been exposed to it. So I think sharing what is possible really helps, certainly disabled people, because it helps you think, well, gee, we can actually get there. This is what accessible transportation may look like. So I think doing a better job of that. And then I think providing technical assistance is really important. And again, I think there are different ways in which that can happen. And leading at the global level is always important.
Good. Right, well now it's really, this forum's in your hands. We're going to turn over to questions. We'll maybe get a few questions and comments and then go back to the panel. I will just remind you, we are recording this, so if you do want to say something, I encourage you to. You will be on the record. I know we have other experts here, other members of the Disability Reference Group. I also encourage you to participate. I think Lachlan has to change the battery. Is that all done? Good?
No.
Oh, you are going to. While he's doing that, let me just say that if...
So you're not on the record now.
Well, no. This is more a personal announcement. Actually, my wife's away, and... If I've got a sick kid. So the only phone I'll take is if my kid rings. That's if I have to do that. But I hope I won't. So who's going to be... Who'd like to get the ball rolling? Get us started? Yeah. So maybe... Have we got... We normally have microphones for this, do we? No, we don't have microphones. Just speak loudly and maybe mention your name. Just name where you're from. And over to you.
I'd like to get away with two comments if I can. I'm Christine Moulton, I'm the Executive Officer of the Australian Disability Development, the first one is that, this being an election year, if you go to our webpage, we've got a call to action to our politicians, and I'm bringing that to your attention because it aligns with what Charlotte had to say in her comments about the political buy-in and about how it has to be not just a policy, it has to be systemic within any policy. So what we're actually, one of our asks is to have an ambassador for disability, as we have for the HIV within the AusAid office. And the only way we're going to get that is if people make it known that that's what we need. So we've been lobbying very hard to both the Coalition and to the Labor government to say this is an opportunity to either make a statement that you're going to do it or to do it now. We're asking for it to be appointed roughly to deputy Director General's position, so it will be a systemic way of thinking within the program and development area. So don't go away and just say you had a nice morning or afternoon. You can do something. You can write that letter and ask them to write to the Foreign Minister or the Shadow Foreign Minister, and you can make that difference. So I encourage you quite actively. The second thing is I have to do this. It's when we were working on today, the flyer that came out to say, is disability the latest fad? And obviously I reacted quite passionately because a few of my colleagues asked what's wrong. I found that a really disturbing question. And the question one of my colleagues said to me was, perhaps you could ask, would they be game enough to say, is gender the latest fad? And if so, would you be brave enough to put that in writing? So I challenge that, and that just shows me how people are thinking about disability still. Thank you.
Okay, that's good. Well, thanks for the comments, and maybe we'll go on to another one and maybe come back to the panel. People can react to the comments a bit later on.
Yeah, I'm Jonathan Pryke from the Development Policy Centre, and it seems like the common theme here is the institutionalisation of this issue in development practice. My question is, we're now 4 years into AusAid's five-year disability inclusive development strategy. How is AusAid progressing on institutionalising and incorporating into AusAid's DNA? And what more needs to be done both internally within AusAid, and what can we do as both internal and external actors in aid development space to improve this institutionalisation?
Yeah, so I guess these members are from the reference group. But I guess you have your own views of AusEd. You must see AusEd every now and then.
Yeah.
And I know Fleur's here from AusEd. Maybe you could also contribute to that question. Yeah. So anyone else like to contribute to the discussion at this point? Yeah, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Hashim Milan. I'm with the CBM Norse Partnership at the University of Melbourne. My question relates to the issue around non-discrimination, which has two equal parts of equality and equity. In terms of equity, is my question, the 15% and 1.2 billion gets presented in forums. Do the representation from the DPOs give that equity in the representation of the 1.2 billion, or what proportion of that gets represented by DPOs? It's the first question. The second is, in terms of the historical analysis of conventions and legal instruments around the world, to take the example of the US, the legal arguments would be that looking at the census, it indicates at that time there are 43 million people with disabilities in the US. And the legislations, the various legislations, including the Individuals with Disability Education Act, ADA, and so on, the case law and such things accounted for analysis which indicated that only 30 million people were covered under those body of legislation. So when you look at that, what do the panel's perspective on the coverage of the UNCRPD and your comments on that, please?
Okay, thank you very much. Well, especially with this last question on the US, and it is kind of your turn, Charlotte, to start. So would you be willing to kick off the panel's response?
Yeah, sure. I mean, just to Christine's point, and I'm not sure that you were hoping the panel would answer it. I think that that question was more directed at Stephen, but I'll give it a shot. I mean, I think disability inclusive development is absolutely not a fad. I think, if anything, it's increasingly a development issue that's being discussed in very serious fora. Last week, it was being discussed at the Indigenous Peoples Forum. In September, there's going to be a high-level meeting in New York on disability and inclusive and development that will bring together, hopefully, heads of state, but certainly very senior people from government. So it's not a fad. I mean, I think it's very much a piece of our development discourse today. Jonathan, you know, I think I was one of the early members of the Disability Reference Group for AusEd, and actually even before that commented on the Development for All strategy when I was at the bank in its draft form. And I think if we look at the time frame that AusEd has had in relation to this strategy, I think that they have been great advancements in addressing and working towards institutionalizing the issue of disability inclusive development. I think that, you know, there's always room for more, but I do think that there has been a significant amount of progress in relation to that. I just think that even our last couple of meetings, and we're speaking to some of the same people, and you can see that their knowledge of the issue has increased in 2 years. But I do think that, you know, we would like to see that it really becomes an integral piece of all of their work. So I think it's work in progress. And I hope one of the things that our group does is to continuously remind AusEd of the importance of institutionalizing that. So that's, you know, that's partly one of our roles. You know, Hashim, I think in terms of the coverage of the CRPD, I mean, I think the CRPD obviously applies to all persons with disabilities, irrespective. And I think that it's difficult to say what the percentage is right now, in terms of the benefits of the CRPD, because it really, it still is a very new document, a new treaty. I think countries are, those member states that have ratified are in the process of looking at various, looking at implementation. So I think it's early days to actually say, you know, what percentage or what is the coverage in terms of that document. But that said, I think it provides an excellent framework for universal coverage. And I think that, you know, as governments think about, you know, sectoral policies, that's something that they will hopefully will be thinking about. But I think it's an area to be mindful of and one to watch.
Great, thank you. Sida, would you like to?
Yeah, just very briefly on the where OZD is now in terms of the DNA in disability inclusive development within OZD. Like Charlotte, along with one of the early members of the reference group, but also quite actively involved in the development of the DFA development for all itself, particularly from the Pacific. It is certainly evident, and I think I'd like to link the evidence of the increasing awareness and the willingness, the filtering down to the post, the OZAID post in country, and I'm talking about the Pacific here. How OZAID missions, OZAID posts, the staff are being made aware, and in some cases are actually playing doing a very good job about ensuring the active participation, a person's disabilities, consultation, genuine consultation with disabled persons organizations. So across the Pacific, where the, and there's been sharing of information, and I think some also training of OZAID staff to embrace and also deliver on the DFA strategies, as well as actually try to embed that in their day-to-day work. So, like Charlotte, it is work in progress. Where are we now? 2013, four years down the road after implementation of the development for all, I guess 3 years more seriously. The even in terms of the support to I guess the last question around DPO involvement, I think it's depends on the space that's given to them, how they can represent themselves. I end up when, a couple of years back, I went to one of the Pacific Island countries, and that's the first time they saw a blind person working with a kid. So you come across these kind of situations where you get to meet with people the reality that I think that Charles talked about earlier about. Even the possibilities. Can persons with disabilities go to school? I mean, those things are very important, very key, and DPOs can address those, one, if they're given space to mobilize themselves and given room and support where necessary to voice, to be their own voice in advocating their issues.
Good, thank you. Montian.
Here. Thank you again. Well, first of all, it's time for me to talk about OZAID now, but now that I've covered the content that I wanted to say. I think it's because of OZAID, strong effort on this issue. We have seen recognition of so-called disability inclusive development being articulated in many regional, international policy framework and guidance, and all kinds of things like that are being well more recognized for the past few years, and I can witness that because I've been through all of this formulation among development. Professionals, I think this concept is beginning to sink in, and from observing from a perspective of a DRG member, I could see that within OZAID, we have seen more effort from different sectors to involve disability perspective to make their programs more disability inclusive. That's a welcoming sign. We just need to go further to see the real indicator of the practice of that. And we see the energy coming from different sides now. We see the document, we see the written statement, we see the planning and also acknowledgement from top down to the practitioners. But we have to look further to see the actual outcome. And I think Aussie is heading towards that direction. So having said that, I think we are positive. And that's why I keep saying that we have to give up on giving up. Mm. And as far as the question concerning the coverage of the law, citing from USF as an example, in the human rights perspective, you know, statistics cannot justify to do or not to do. It's even if we have one single person, we have to do it. And actually, CRPD recognized disability among those who never even identify themselves as persons with disabilities. So it's beyond the scope of any statistics or data collection. It's something that is quite it's a great challenge to all of us. You know, we are striving to meet this very high goal, but yet we have to come back to reality as well. Yeah. So even if we have been able to achieve only 1 in 100. Or climb up to 10 or 20 or 30%. That only reminds us that we need to do more. That's it. We cannot just say, "Oh, we're not going to get there, so why just stay away from it?" No, we cannot do that. Mm.
Mm. Good. Flo, did you want to add anything?
I'll talk very briefly because I think we very much agree with the panel's assessment. We've made some progress. We can point to some of the achievements through the strategy, concrete things like children being able to go to school as a result of our mainstream education programs, looking at the issues of disability, incorporating RAMs, training teachers in inclusive education approaches and that sort of thing. We have a much stronger awareness amongst AusAid staff of the issues than we did a few years ago. And definitely very strong leadership up to the top. Our Director General's in Vietnam today with the Executive Director of UNICEF, launching the State of the World's Children Report, which focuses on children with disability this year. I'm going to have to leave in a moment to provide some final updates to the speech so that you can play that global leadership role that we're trying to play on disability as well. And I think that's something to note, that we really see part of our contribution in this space is not just what we're trying to do through our aid program, which is very important, but also advocating on this issue internationally so that others, UNICEF, the World Bank, other donors, and countries in our region are looking at how they can progress these issues as well. So, thank you.
Okay, thanks. We'll go back for more questions. I'll just, I didn't want to participate because I'm the chair, but since the question of the flyer came up, and I did work on the flyer, I'm sorry, Christine, if you didn't like it, but I guess we, as a think tank, we do try to bring together people with different views, and we often have arguments. You know, a lot of people actually think the aid budget should be cut, right? And so we argue about aid and, you know, whether it should be increased or cut. Now it can be better spent. I think it's good to have these questions raised, and we're having a good discussion today. So that's in defence of the flyer, but that's all. I am only chairing the event, so. I do want to encourage more questions, please.
Thank you. My name is Beth Sprunt. I'm from the Nossal Institute for Global Health, also within the Saviour Nossal Partnership for Disability Inclusive Development. So I've got two questions. One is, so disability inclusive development, I was put on my teacher's hat, has often been known as a twin track, where you have disability specific services are needed, as well as mainstreaming disability within development programs. So my question is, have we, having come, you know, so 30 years ago where it was heavily around rehab and assistive devices and medical intervention, where we're probably now, you know, we're certainly looking at the mainstreaming track a lot more, but are we at the point now where we need to think, actually, the health systems that need to make this all work, are they keeping up with this agenda? Mm. Are we also meeting those specific needs of people with disability? And the second question, with the post-2015 discussions that are going on with, you know, a lot of hope for social inclusion, do you imagine that we'll, you know, those of us who are involved in this disability inclusive development movement, what do we think this will feel like? You know, do you feel that there are any changes on the horizon?
Okay, good questions. We'll take a few more or other comments.
My name's Robin James. I'm from an organisation called APIDS. I just have a question about the Buwako Millennium Framework, which I realise it's finished. I just wonder if the panel has any comments on what did that achieve? What were some of the achievements of the league?
Okay. Yeah.
There's somebody in the back.
All right, they're great questions. I think, and I'll open it to anyone who'd like to go first, or you don't have to answer all of them, whichever ones you think you can best contribute on.
Before I forget, yeah. Can I?
Yeah, sure, you've got the mic.
I'm getting a bit short-term memory. Dealing with the question of how do we see ourselves in the post-2015, I think we have to really look at two spectrums here. We see disability as a cross-cutting issue, you know, that should be included in all aspects of whether existing aid goals or more goals or whatever the MDGs will produce or post-MDGs will produce. We see disability issue. But through that sense, we also need to address disability issue that needs extra attention, not because we want to be isolated, but we want to call attention that has been lacking for so long. Something that I think the gender people have done quite successfully is that they say, oh yeah, we are part of the intersectionality, you know, part of the marginalized, vulnerables, but we have extra value to that. We need to keep the gender as both integral part of the marginalized and a special issue. I think disability also needs that kind of mentality, you know, because it is disproportionately neglected issue. It has been so. So we need to see it from both dimensions. That's what I think we have to work for. And I think I'm beginning to see that a lot of people are moving that direction as well. As disability inclusive development versus disability specific services, I don't think it's either or. I think we're moving towards the direction of inclusive society, all inclusion, where everybody counts. Whether it is mainstream services or disability-specific services, it must be for that purpose. The purpose of ensuring that persons with disabilities can fully and effectively participate in all aspects of life in the open, democratic,
participatory, you know, inclusive society. That's a thing. So I see disability-specific services as just part of the whole system, not the either-or kind of analysis like we used to think in the past. We have no other choice. We have to move to the direction of, you know, being part of the whole thing.
Do you mind if I add to that? Because Thailand is such an interesting example. The nuance to the question is not should we, but are we? I know full well that we need, you know, we need both sides of that twin track. My question is programmatically, what we're seeing globally, are we getting enough funding and our health systems actually keeping up with the demand that really should be arising and, in my experience, is arising, where you're, you know, you've got people with disability who are aware of their rights and who, you know, maybe an education system is starting to be capable of including them properly, but they just don't have funding to get access to assistive devices and or rehabilitation or whatever the, you know, the short-term medical intervention might be. Do we actually have enough that's keeping both sides of the twin track?
I think I'd like to quote Mahatma Gandhi if I can. But I think we have enough resource for everyone in the world, but we don't have enough resource for one greedy person. You know, it depends on how we manage our resources that we have. Do we, you know, about how do we distribute resources? How do we make sure that assistive devices are being purchased, procured, or even developed wisely? When we're talking about accessibility, are we making use of universal design enough? Are we making of locally available, affordable assistive device based on open standards, or we spend so much money on proprietary standard assistive device? You know, and all kinds of things. It's just like how we do it, rather than whether it should be done or not. Thank you.
Okay, great. We might go to Seta, because I'm sure these questions about resource constraints are very applicable for Pacific Island countries.
I was going to dodge that question.
Here you go, just in front of you.
Okay. Anyway, I'll start with Robin's question about the Biwako Millennium Framework. Yes, that was from 2003 to 2012, last year. And then I certainly can say, I guess from the Pacific speaking generally, the BMF, the Biwako Millennium Framework, with its seven areas, have paid great dividends in disability work in the Pacific. It has provided a policy framework for countries, so more Pacific Island countries within the period of the BMF have developed disability policies. There was also a strategy within the BMF of a sub-regional mechanism, and I was talking to Senator Montan a few days ago about this, and how the Pacific has captured that, and BMF has allowed, given us a space to focus on the sub-region, because Asia-Pacific is huge. It's two-thirds of the population here, and it's very big, and when a small Pacific Island country was sitting alongside these big Asian giants like India and China, we are nowhere. So I think the idea of a sub-regional focus has been a real blessing to the Pacific. I think that has kind of supported and really enhanced our own development in the Pacific. In terms of the, I could quite get the last question, but for Beth's question in terms of twin tracks, certainly the we would like also to encourage other DRG members to speak around this issue, because we were talking about health earlier on today around services. I think that the issue around the medical model, and I think sometimes it can become very tricky. Medical model was the human rights model, was disabilities, and where is the interconnection if there is one? So as person disabilities, I mean, I made a comment earlier this morning that we do get sick, we need those assistive devices. But I think it's in who's delivering that service. The frame in which that service has been provided and delivered. I think and how the consultation. And I think to me, the twin track bit of that in the specialist services is how persons with disabilities are consulted and engaged in not alone, not just in the using of it, but even the design, the planning of those services. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Ed. Charlotte, accountability and anything else?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts on a couple of other things,
yeah,
too.
Of course.
So, I mean, I think Beth's question is a really important one. And I think that, you know, for the disability movement, I think in its effort to move away from the medical model, there was almost this throwing the baby away with the bathwater. And I think that increasingly there is kind of a recognition that, you know, the health sector is possibly the one sector where we haven't seen disability inclusion as much as we should. And again, I think this is not, you know, a particular agency. I think this is across the board. So, you know, to your point, should healthcare systems be, is there enough? Absolutely not. Should it be a focus? Absolutely yes. But I think it needs to be a focus in terms of seeing health broadly. So looking at primary healthcare, looking at secondary healthcare, and, you know, all of the aspects around healthcare. I have to say that I was encouraged because last week in Geneva, the WHO held a session, a high-level meeting, a panel actually, and it brought together senior people from various donors and other think tanks to start developing some ideas for the health sector in relation to disability inclusive development for the meeting in September. So I think that that's good. And I think this is something that DPOs also need to get on board about, because health is far more than just, you know, P&O and rehab services. That said, that is an important piece of it, but I think that that's an area that we need to look at more closely. I think there's been some work done in the area of HIV and AIDS, and looking at, you know, better programming or more inclusive programming. But really, I think it's an area where much, much more can be done. So to the issue around accountability mechanisms, I mean, I think, you know, obviously USAID is accountable broadly to the taxpayers, right? And then secondly, I think more specifically in relation to the disability issues, we report to Congress. And we do so on a yearly basis in terms of, you know, what we've been doing in terms of implementing programs. You know, there isn't a formal mechanism within the agency per se, something that I think may be worth thinking about. But again, I think it's about ensuring that it's part of the M&E process, you know, and that, you know, people are thinking about it across the board, but we don't have a specific, we have various types of reporting, but it's not necessarily an accountability mechanism as a standalone, so you've got these different pieces happening.
Just clarify, when you say you report to Congress, is that in general, or do you mean specifically on disability?
Specifically on disability
development.
Yeah.
Okay, very interesting. All right, well, look, sadly, we are pretty much out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up. I guess if there are any final comments or questions people would like to make, this is your last chance, and then we'll go back to the panel for their final comments, and we'll have to leave it there. So we are going to take people who haven't asked questions. I'm sorry, Ashim. There's one here, and one maybe at the back first, and then, yeah.
Shirley Thompson, I won't pause, but I have been a special needs officer for the Australian Defence Force. 5 years with Cerebral Palsy, special needs, that sort of stuff. So seen a wide variety. Mine's more of a, it's not a very clear question, but I just sort of wanted to talk about disability inclusive development. We talk a lot about physical disability, and that's a no-brainer, creating space, obviously, to participate in society for people who have physical disabilities. But what's your comments on people with mental disability or mental impairment, how will we discuss it now, and in creating space in society for them? So there's organisations such as Special Olympics that do amazing work in sport, but how about when it comes to creating meaningful, sort of meaningful spaces within society for these people so they can participate, not just work in other areas. Sort of just comments on that, or examples that you've seen of organisations that are
you. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I'm Inga During from the German Development Cooperation, representing GIZ on the Disability Reference Group for AUSAID.
Welcome.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be here indeed, and I would like to highlight that the German Development Cooperation is seriously looking into the matter of disability and inclusive development since several years. But what I would like to highlight here and put to the audience once again is that certainly it is an international development issue, but it is an important issue of international cooperation as well. In Germany, for example, we have had a very long tradition of very specialized services for persons with disabilities in all areas of society. And on a domestic issue, we are having hard times. It's a very difficult transition from a very specialized system into a truly inclusive system. And if we look at inclusive education, for example, certainly Germany has to learn from other countries, and be it countries traditionally called as developing countries or being other countries around the world. So I would like to highlight that disability inclusive international cooperation is certainly an issue where we have to think where, how to position ourselves for the coming 10 years and what the different roles of the different stakeholders could be in international cooperation and in exchange of experiences in this regard. So be it disabled people's organization, be it academia, be it private stakeholders and service providers, where do we want to be in 5 years and what is our role or specific role in 10 years, for example? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, all right, I think this is the very last question at the back.
Sorry, my name is Julianne Nessie. I'm a graduate student from Syracuse University in New York. And I just have a question for the panel, maybe more of advice. In terms of how do you work with non-government groups who are advocating for policies, but yet how do you advocate in terms of recognizing that there are racial, gender, and class differences in these needs that are specified within specific communities? So I'm just wondering about your advice on how do we, as an NGO, for instance, advocate for those needs along those lines. Because I think a lot of times within policy, or just, I guess, in the U.S. context, that whole section around rendered race, gender, and class is pretty much normalized as if it's the same across the board for all disability communities. So I'm just wondering how would you suggest, or what are some advice that you would suggest around those terms?
Great. All right, well, I think we've got three sort of very big picture questions and comments. We can't go on forever, but I think I'm glad we've got such a good panel, because I'm sure you can handle it all. This will be your last chance to speak, so whatever you'd like to leave us with, this is your chance. I will have to ask you to keep it short, I'm afraid. And whoever would like to start? It's a matter of volunteering.
Start of the senator.
Okay, I think, Senator, you've been volunteered.
I've been forced to. just kidding. Well, before going into the conclusion, I think I had to answer a question with regard to some reference to Thailand when it comes to the health issue. I think this is one issue that we managed to put disability as part of the whole so-called national healthcare service. Not specifically about rehabilitation, not specifically about disability-related issues. But disability-related services are part of that integral national healthcare policy. And so that's, I hope that answers. But it's still far from reality, because whenever I go to a doctor, they keep asking about my eyesight rather than my sickness, illness. So, well, I think we have to really go back to how we think about disability. If we think about disability from traditional medical pathological model, I think we're going to fix disability and we're going to shy away from it. But if we're thinking of disability as part of our everyday life, it could happen anytime, and it's a social construction in our mind, in our system, in our infrastructure. The thing is that if we're dealing it with, you know, from this perspective, whether you call it development model, social model, or human rights model, you are going to think about it as something that will be part of the whole process of development, as AUSAID is trying to do. And inclusiveness is about participation. You know, without effective, full and effective participation by those who are being targeted, it's meaningless. And we have been very innovative about that. The concept of DPO, Disabled Persons Organization, is unique within itself. That I'm not saying that it is different from other NGOs, but I think it shows how people who realize that they have knowledge, they have problems and vision, and the way of thinking that they want to share among themselves and advocate. So by acknowledging that as a beginning part of participation, I think we're on the right track. But finally, eventually, disability is not about one particular person, one particular group. It's about everyone in the society. And when I'm talking about disability, I think it should apply across the board through all impairment, not only physical, not only sensory, but across the board. You know, and we should talk more about supported decision making if you want to talk about, you know, intellectual disability. But are we able to overcome that kind of, you know, stigma? I hope you will move on and please give up on giving up.
Terrific. Charlotte, do you want to...
Yeah, sure. So I think to Shani's point, and thank you for raising it, because I think it's an area that is often neglected in the development field. And actually, to be very honest, in the disability movement itself, it's often an area that is least discussed, and I think it's clearly an important area. So I think just by acknowledging it is really a good step. I think there are some interesting things happening in the realm of the inclusion of persons with intellectual disabilities, and I think there's some great examples actually coming out of Australia. But I think, you know, you have organizations like Inclusion International, which is a member of the International Disability Alliance. So they do have a voice within that larger, that broader platform of you know, disability organizations. And then again, I think, you know, just to draw reference from the CRPD, which clearly speaks to the importance of the inclusion of all persons with disabilities and addresses the issue of the inclusion of people with intellectual disabilities. But I think, honestly, it's an area where we haven't done enough. It's an area where we need to invest in research. We need to invest in what are the good practices, and really gain a lot more knowledge around how we can do, you know, how we can include people with intellectual disabilities in a meaningful way, so that we're not looking at a tokenistic kind of, okay, we've got, you know, people with intellectual disabilities present, but really not doing it in a sincere and genuine fashion. So that's one point. You know, to the point from Syracuse, I think I think you raise a really important issue. I think, you know, I think it's something that, again, the area of research is really needed. I know that there are a couple of people in the U.S. that are working on PhDs looking at the intersection between, say, disability and race, and what that means, because that context is a very different one. Looking at, you know, the intersectionality between disability and gender is really an important one, and is emerging as a real issue. Certainly within the organization and within the agency in which I work, but I think just globally, there's an increased awareness that, you know, that there's so many commonalities, and yet there's so many nuanced issues around that. So, you know, to the mainstream, to people working in the area of mainstream gender work, to start thinking about this. So again, a challenge. And then, of course, the class is an important one. Beth had mentioned the issue, and this will be my closing point, Stephen. Beth had mentioned the issue around the post-2015 agenda. And I think that this is really, really an excellent opportunity for us to try and get some serious visibility of this issue as a development issue. And whether, you know, whether it's inequality or social exclusion or, you know, a standalone goal, I think the important piece is getting deliberate and specific indicators and targets on disability, because this will help us look at what the picture really is, help in hopefully collecting disaggregated data, but also help raising the issue. So using it as an advocacy, you know, using that platform, whatever it turns out to be, as an advocacy platform. And I think that we can all play a role in doing that. I mean, I think that fortunately this process has been a lot more inclusive, just in terms of the way they're going about it. So, you know, I think whether you're working in an NGO or an academia or in a donor agency, there is a role for you to play in terms of, you know, pushing, trying to influence more inclusive frameworks that do reflect the importance of disability.
Great. Thanks, Charlotte. And Seta, you have the last word.
Yes, my last word is it's not business as usual. We've heard this shared amongst ourselves this week. Good development practice will have to include disability. And disability is not a homogeneous group. The question that was raised about intellectual disability, certainly it is a challenge for us in the Pacific. It is an area that the DPOs are evolving and are growing. How then they are addressing within the movement, even the minority groups within the disability movement, like person intellectual disability. Some of the countries like Fiji are beginning to address those. But I think for really, my parting words is, what is the cost of excluding persons with disabilities? What is the cost to development? What is the cost to a country? What is the cost of program for excluding persons with disabilities? Because I think that will challenge our thinking, and that's why I started, my parting words in, it should not be business as usual now. Things have to change if development has to be good development. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Seta. I'm not going to try to summarize the rich discussion we've had today. I'll just say the words that come to mind are rich and learning and inspirational. Before we close, can I just thank everyone involved in organizing today's event. I've already thanked our partners, but a couple of individuals, Lachlan and Macarena, thank you very much. And of course, our interpreters, I'm sorry I didn't get to meet you and know your name, but thank you very much. And thank you all for coming. It's great to have such a good turnout. It shows the interest. I'm sure, you know, we could do a lot more in this area with your support. But I think, at least for a while, we've been holding back our applause. Several times I felt like applauding. So I think now is the time to show our thanks to our three speakers.